Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Nathan Hartshorn. I'm an assistant attorney general. I'm here representing the appellant in this matter, who is Steve Simon, the Minnesota Secretary of State. This is a case of statutory interpretation. It has to do with the construction of MnStat section 201.091, the statute that governs public access to the data in the Minnesota statewide voter registration database. I wanted to start this morning with a provision in the statute that got relatively less attention in the party's briefs. It was addressed, certainly, but not as extensively as some of the others. As this court is well aware, the fundamental object of statutory construction is to ascertain and effectuate the intention of the legislature. And I wanted to start with this provision because I think this particular provision provides an uncommonly clear window into the legislature's intention writ large in the big picture for the statute as a whole. The provision I'm talking about is the final paragraph of subdivision 4 of section 201.091. Now, subdivision 4 overall creates and defines a thing called the public information list, which is a subset of the information that's on the database as a whole. Subdivisions 4 and 5 make that subset accessible by the public. The final paragraph of subdivision 4 is very consequential as far as ascertaining the intention of the legislature because of what it does and does not say. Now, as the parties agree, and I think every forum that has looked at this agrees, the purpose, the legislative intent behind that final paragraph of sub 4 is to create a process by which a group of voters that we've called safety at risk voters, voters who live in fear of stalking or domestic violence or similar crimes, can protect their data, specifically their names, from access by stalkers, domestic abusers, and similar people intending to carry out those kinds of crimes. But what's especially consequential here is the manner in which the legislature gave those people the authority to protect their names. Now, specifically, what that paragraph says is that when a safety at risk voter submits a written statement to the secretary that says, in essence, I am a safety at risk voter, the secretary is then required to remove that person's name from the public information list.
Fine. I mean, we all agree that government data is presumed public.
Correct.
And what we get down to is whether you're under the unless part of the provision.
Indeed.
So you're talking about domestic violence survivors. They're carved out. Do you not distinguish them from the general public?
In the DPA sense, in the 201.091 sense?
That their information is not public.
Well, under the general structure of 201.091, if subdivision 4 did not have this paragraph in it, their information would be part of the public information list that then could be accessed.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. Wasn't there a stipulation in the lower court?
At the 11th hour, the plaintiff respondents did say, we are not seeking any information pertaining to safety at risk voters. That's correct.
Well, they did more than that, right? They stipulated to a number of factors under the statute, including that any information regarding a voter registered and safe at home as well. In other words, the carved out sections.
The plaintiffs in this case did. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. But so let me just stop for a minute. The last sentence in subdivision 4, first paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That references what the Secretary of State may do.
Right.
Regarding the SVRS, information past the other information.
Yes.
Now, is it your position that the Secretary of State can use that provision to favor some groups over others? In other words, one political party over another, and a voting group that's connected to a political party comes to him or her, whoever happens to hold that office, and the Secretary of State, within their discretion, can decide whether to release that information?
There are Your Honor is referring to the sentence in subdivision 4 that creates the discretion in the Secretary of State, and as we've noted, that discretion is not unlimited. There are limitations in the statute, and we've listed what those are. But the specific point that Your Honor points to as to whether the Secretary of State can decide that some people seeking to use information in what are the uses related to elections, political activities, et cetera, are different than others. The legislature has not here controlled the secretary's discretion to that degree on those particular grounds.
And there are no rules or regulations defining those parameters?
Specific to that, to the exercise of that discretion, no, that's correct.
Mr. Hartshorn,
yes,
that provision you were pointing to in subdivision 4,
yes.
And the onus is on the voter registrant to affirmatively indicate that I want to be my name off of the list.
Correct.
So when that's submitted to the county auditor at the time of the registration, that comes off the list.
I think that's almost correct. Under that paragraph, the Secretary of State, who frequently is the party that hands out a public information list, the Secretary of State and county auditor then withhold that person's name from the public.
So assuming that's the case, mm-hmm. even under the respondent's interpretation of that statute, why under what scenario would that name be available under the list, even if they had not stipulated, in other words, that they're not interested in that information? Because I understand from your argument that leads to some sort of absurd result because
yes.
of that. That's why you're pointing to that subdivision.
Indeed.
But what under their request prior to the stipulation, if someone came off the list through the process you indicated, it would have been made available?
The position that the plaintiff respondents are forwarding here, that the district court has ruled and the Department of Administration opinion before that the district court relied on, is that data on this database are public whether they're on the public information list or not. And the necessary consequence of that is that this process in that final paragraph does nothing. That person's name comes off the public list. It's still in the database, but it comes off the public list. According to the plaintiffs' understanding of the overall structure of this statute, and according to the district court's ruling on the overall structure of this statute, that has no effect whatsoever. That information is still public.
How does that differ then from subdivision 9, which identifies, for instance, Social Security numbers? So that's off, but under this last paragraph, subdivision 4, isn't that the legislature's directive that if the person so requests, then that's no longer public? So under any request for information, under any interpretation, that will not be provided?
That is, you can only get that result from this paragraph if you also rule that data that's on the database but not on the public information list is therefore not public, which is the secretary's position and not the respondent's position. I mean, what you've just described is, I think, a correct reading of this paragraph, but it requires the reversal of the district court, because if, as the district court has ruled, data in this database is public, whether it's on the public information list or not, then this process of removing that name from the public information list does not make it not public. All it does is it puts it in a different bucket that the stalker can still come in, submit a DPA request, and get. And the DPA request they would submit could look identical to the original DPA request before the subsequent caveat that the plaintiff submitted in this case. The DPA request they submitted would get any name that had been pulled off the public information list if their interpretation of the statute overall is correct. This paragraph
Counsel,
could...
Counsel, I want to be clear on this, though. The respondent with the stipulation is not seeking that information.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the rule of law that the district court has announced and that the plaintiffs are seeking would expose those names to the day after this decision takes effect. These plaintiffs or anybody else could just go get those names that, in this case, the plaintiffs have chosen not to go after. So the rule of law that would result would expose these names. And that's the crucial thing about this paragraph. What it proves is that the legislative intent overall for this statute is for the public information list to be accessible to the public, under certain restrictions, but anyway, accessible but to the public, and the rest of the database not. That's the basic model that this court has recognized in the McGrath decision, that the federal courts recognized in Carlson, and diametrically opposed to that is the administration opinion from 2012 and now the district court decision below. And the fundamental distinction is when information is in the database but not in the public information list, does that mean it's therefore not public? This paragraph forces the response, yes. When it's off the public information list, that makes it not public. The district court in this case has ruled no. When information is on the database but not on the public information list, it's still public. People can still get it. And the necessary consequence of that is that this paragraph becomes meaningless.
Under subdivision 4, though, where it says the Secretary of State may provide copies, isn't that an awful broad grant of discretion that's afforded to the Secretary of State? What precautions or what checks and balances are in place for that?
Well, there are three limitations in the statute that do provide a check on that grant of discretion. Number one is that Subdivision 5 says the Secretary shall provide copies of the public information list to people who qualify for it. So the Secretary doesn't have the discretion to say, oh, you want the public information list? Too bad, I'm not giving it to you. Subdivision 5 says he shall get
copies.
But
it isn't the public information list that we're concerned about.
That's correct.
Right.
I'm trying to explain the limitations that the statute does have on this discretion. So there's that one area in which the Secretary of State, even though he has the discretion, doesn't have the discretion to say no to that particular kind of request. Then there are two instances in which the Secretary doesn't have the authority to say yes. One of them is just the very end of that sentence in first paragraph of sub 4, which is that he can only give the information out for certain purposes. If a Secretary of State, not this one, but if some other Secretary of State had a buddy who was a telemarketer, the Secretary couldn't use his discretion to hand out all of the many telephone numbers in the database to help that telemarketer make a lot of money, because that's not within his discretion.
Well, that might be true, but elections and political activities are very broad.
That's
topics.
Correct. Yeah. I think it is correct to say that the grant of discretion in Subdivision 4 is broad. It's not extraordinarily broad. It's certainly not unlimited, which is my main point here.
What recourse would someone have if there is, I'm not saying that this has ever happened or suggesting that it should, but
right.
If there's an abuse of that discretion, what do voters have as far as a recourse?
Well, I can think of three potential recourses. One of them is, I mean, the terms that you just use, abuse of discretion. Any exercise of discretion by an administrative official that a litigant believes to be an abuse of that discretion can, of course, be challenged in this court and in other courts in the state. So there would be a judicial recourse there. The second would be to go to the legislature and ask them to put in more statutory guidance as to how this discretion can and cannot be exercised. The third, actually, I believe, has happened in this case. The third is the election. The Secretary of State is a constitutional elected official. And in fact, in 2018, the Secretary's approach to this case and to discretionary disclosure of data off this database was a central issue in the Secretary of State election. It was debated between Secretary Simon and his Republican challenger in the election. And the populace then went to the polls in November and reelected Secretary Simon. That is a recourse. If the concern is that Secretary Simon, or any secretary, is using this discretion in a way that's inappropriate, the voters can answer that at the election. And indeed, that was an issue that was put in front of the voters in this very election. So, I mean, it's not academic at all. It's something that actually has happened. With regard to the discretion, I would point out that this grant of discretion is not all that is not particularly unique. There are in Minnesota law there are many grants of discretion to administrative officials that give an agency or a board or a particular official the authority to produce data that's otherwise not public or to withhold it if they determine that it's proper to do so. Now, some of those statutes have particular criteria that a particular finding that the agency has to make in order to withhold the data or in order to disclose it, but not all of them. And two examples that I found specifically on the question of, hey, is there any guidance here? Two of them that I found are MnStat 13.44, so it's in the DPA, MnStat 13.44 subdivision 3C, that has to do with certain kinds of real property data. And under under subdivision 3C of that section, an agency can become public. The agency can make that data public, and there is no particular. The DPA provides no particular criteria that the agency is required to apply in order to make that decision. Another example, MnStat 10A.02, subdivision 12C. That has to do with the opinions of the Campaign Finance Board. The Campaign Finance Board, their opinions are presumptively not public, but the board, at its sole discretion, can decide to publish those opinions. Now, I mean, to the extent that the court is concerned with, you know, political favoritism one way or another, that is at least a potential concern in that statute as well. The Campaign Finance Board could decide they're only going to publish opinions that implicate Democrats but not Republicans or whatever. So it's not at all unheard of for the legislature to create grants of discretion like this that condition the disclosure of government data on an official's discretion. There are many other examples in the DPA and outside the DPA of this kind of discretion. Many of the others have criteria. Those two certainly don't. My time is up at this point. I'm very happy to answer any other questions the court has, but otherwise I'd like to sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall. I represent Andy Selig and the Minnesota Voters Alliance. And I'd like to just reorient the court with respect to the record and the statutes applicable to the state voter registration system. We've heard a lot about 201.091, but the relevant one for the Secretary of State, who is the appellant in the case, is 201.022. It's titled Statewide Registration System. And it says, Subdivision 1, Establishment, the Secretary of State shall maintain a statewide voter registration system to facilitate voter registration and to provide a central database containing voter registration information from around the state. And so this is what the Secretary of State does. 201.091, the one we were talking about, there was one sentence referencing the Secretary of State, but generally that's an instruction to the county auditors. The county auditors collect the voter registration applications, they update the SVRS, but the central database is maintained by the Secretary of State. So my client, understanding the Secretary of State manages and created the statewide voter registration system, which is a database, wrote a letter requesting information from that database. That information included things like the number of the voter, the name of the voter, the address of the voter.
Counsel, as long as you're on that topic, what information that was requested was refused? In other words, what information was not given?
Among those things, the voter history indicating the ballot type, the voter status, active, inactive, deleted, challenged, reason for the challenge, that information, the information that wouldn't be available on the public information list.
But it's available on the SVRS.
Well, that's right. And, Your Honor, one of the challenges here for the court and for me in keeping up with the Secretary of State's arguments.
Can you tell me, is the history of the detailed history for the elections, has that also been refused, right?
That's right. So I don't want to refer to a footnote in the district court opinion unless I have to, and I have to here. The district court judge was frustrated a little bit with the lack of records, because when you're requesting data, like we were talking about, requesting data from a database, you know, and the government doesn't sort of own up to managing and creating the database, the court required us to do a deposition, basically, of the Secretary of State's office, Mr. Poser. And Mr. Poser testified at the deposition that, in fact, the Secretary of State does maintain this central database called the Statewide Voter Registration System. And each person who's voted in Minnesota has a unique voter identification number. They're never removed from that database. There are 5.42 million voter records there with 19 different data fields. In footnote 12, the judge wrote, the court denied defendant's earlier motion to dismiss in part because the location, classification, manner of maintenance of voter records requested by plaintiffs was unknown, and the question of whether voter records exist on a list or in some other form was a proper subject for discovery. Unfortunately, the record still does not answer the question of how the Secretary or others classify the requested data. Although the record shows that the data exists in the SVRS on servers in the Secretary's office
and that county auditors are responsible for maintaining the data fields attributable to any particular voter, Poser Deposition 6 or 8, the record does not show how the data is classified. So in other words, we proved our case that the Secretary of State has the data we requested, but the Secretary of State's arguments here aren't backed up in the record. We don't know how to respond to these kind of arguments without a record, that, you know, there's a master list out there, there's a voter list. What's clear to us is that there's an SVRS, and when there's a list created under 201.091 by the county auditor, it's a subset of the SVRS.
Mr. Cardle, the information, I'm assuming by that, by the way, this side point, that there's not a separate computer system in each county with the same information all sent into one database. But my question really, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on that from your understanding now, how much of the information that your client requested did not derive from a voter registration form that individual voters fill out?
I mean, I think all the information, or a lot, the personal information is from the voter registration application. The voting data, of course, comes from the different precincts.
Does that mean the information your client requested is not the information that it's held by other sources than what the SVRS, at least initially, was set up for information from this voter registration card? When I fill out that form, that has certain personal information, but what your client's asking for is information that was derived from sources other than that card.
Well, it would be from that card, too. I mean, that information's put into the SVRS. That's the information we're requesting. It's all data input, right?
And so the voter eligibility information, though, on felony, conviction, discharge, and all that information, or the non-voting status, that phrase, whatever that phrase was used, where does that information come from? How does the Secretary get that information?
From the Department of Corrections, the courts, the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's all by statute. The Secretary of State is the aggregating point for the information. It's regularly updated through the election. It's part of the proficiency of our system, as the Secretary of State collects that data from the different agencies pursuant to statute and then puts it into the database, and then it's available for dissemination prior to the election.
And is it that information that your clients believe is not restricted by 201.091, therefore under the data practices must be made available unless there's some other statutory...
Right. I think that the simplest way to put it, Judge, is that my client just read Chapter 13 and said, this is public data, we request it. 201.091 is a different type of request. I mean, this is such a natural reading of the statutes is afforded even by when you read the section 206. Hold on a second. When you read the section, two, I think it's 20, let's see, here it is, 13.607, which is cited as an important section by the Secretary of State. It's the one where it has subdivision 6, registered voter lists. Access to registered voter lists is governed by section 201.091. Well, when we read a statute like this, we should read the introduction, right? The introduction says, scope. The sections referred to in this section are codified outside this chapter. So in other words, we're enacting the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, but there are some sections that already address some of these things, and we're not necessarily repealing them. Those sections classify campaign, ethics, and election data as other than public, place restrictions on access to government data, or involve data sharing. So a natural reading would be that subdivision 6 involves additional data sharing between the county auditors and the public. So rather than restricting Chapter 13, as the Secretary of State has argued, it may very well be that we have the same rights regarding the Secretary of State as any other public official with respect to this government data. But there's another requirement on the county auditors with respect to sharing registered voter lists because those are deemed to be important. So there are different timelines. They have to get it out quicker. There isn't a timeline under the Minnesota Government Data Practice Act, for example. And so when, in the very first instance, why can't our petition, our request for government data just be taken as a Chapter 13 request, and we didn't request something under the other statute. And in that way, you can see we've requested data Gary Poser, at least, the Director of Elections, has said the data is available. And then when we apply the 13.03 statutory presumption, which the court is aware of, that government data is public unless another statute says it's not public, then we should just simply get the data. That's the simplest view of the case. Now, when we take the argument of the Secretary of State, it gets complicated because there's some obstructions to their statutory interpretation. One is 201.091 is directed to county auditors, not the Secretary of State. As I quoted the statute, 201.022, which is directed to the Secretary of State, and that regards the Secretary of State managing the statewide voter registration system as a database. In conversations the court may have been engaged in, and maybe previous decisions, listening to state legislative arguments, reading the Office of Legislative Auditors report, it is just commonplace vernacular that the Secretary of State himself talks about the statewide voter registration system as a central database. The Department of Corrections, Department of Motor Vehicles, this court system that you're a part of, delivers information to the Secretary of State, which is put into the database, which modifies the data fields, according to the Director of Elections, Mr. Poser, which ends up creating then the data for the precinct rosters, so when you show up to vote, you're checked off.
Counsel, I have a question regarding what your opponent suggested. You have a stipulation here for what he referenced as carve-outs, in other words, portions of 201.091 that are restricted, and you weren't seeking. Is that correct?
That's right. Subdivision 9, right. And then the safety at risk.
Safety at risk and a couple other areas. Your opponent suggested that the way that the lower court wrote its decision or opinion would provide that information would be public as well, even though you're not seeking it. A reading of that lower court decision would open the door to the restricted data. What's your response to that?
I don't think so. I think that's why the restrictions are in Subdivision 9 and in Subdivision 4. And I don't think that the Secretary of State's position on that is well taken. And if there is a problem with the statute, let's say, for example, this is the first time a party like my client has requested this type of information. This request itself doesn't pose a problem because we have the carve-outs, then the statute should be modified. The Chapter 13 should be modified to incorporate the exceptions that the Secretary of State is raising now. The Secretary of State is a powerful office and can get changes in the statutes. It's very difficult for citizens to do that because of the time and expense.
But in the interim between a court decision and the legislature remedying the statute, wouldn't a lot of information arguably be made available that shouldn't, including the carve-outs that you agreed to?
Well, we're agreeing to the carve-outs, so there won't be any harm from distribution to us.
From you, I understand.
Right.
But, again, if the interpretation of the decision that was given to us from the lower court reads as your opponent suggests, then people that are in some danger would have information made available by that lower court decision until the legislature amended the statute to meet that problem.
Yeah, if that's the case, yes.
Do you envision any stopgap measure that could be implemented?
Sure. This has cost to my client this litigation tens of thousands of dollars. If this is a principle, the Secretary of State wants to, you know.
I guess what I'm getting at is if we agree with you and we rule in your favor and someone is at risk, what can he or she do in order to stop dissemination of information that may in fact identify them?
Well, the Secretary of State has accomplished through this litigation preventing that from happening. I have confidence the Secretary of State, if there are future inquiries in this regard where people won't stipulate to the carve-outs, that it'll be back in court until there's some sort of legislative fix. The Secretary of State has done a wonderful job of protecting the information. That's not the issue. The issue is the Secretary of State allowing the public data, which doesn't have compromising information and safety at risk people, to the proper parties. So I understand that the issue. But again, you're right that the, if the court were to write an opinion in my client's favor, you'd want to express a concern about that, because it appears that these two statutes aren't supposed to be interpreted together, Chapter 13 and 201.091. But 201.91, as I indicated, in 13.607, is just another way of sharing data with the public. And in the 201.091, which is very specific to the Secretary of State, these things were drafted and included. In Chapter 13, which is not specific to the Secretary of State, of course, it's the general Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, these things aren't specific. Although I have not checked Chapter 13 for a general safety at risk exclusion and so forth, it's possible that it's in there anyway. There are a lot of protections of confidentiality. In fact, I can't imagine it wouldn't be there, but maybe it isn't. I see my time is coming to an end. I just want to end up on the point that without the record, it's been very record developed to match the Secretary of State's arguments regarding how the county auditors work, how the master lists work, how all these things. It's been very difficult to respond because all the record shows is the Secretary of State has the information we've requested. And if we get judgment here, then we'll get the information we've requested. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardall. You'll have that last word.
Please, Your Honor. There are a couple of things that I very much need to address. The first point came from questions from both Judge Cleary and Judge Werke, specifically on what information the plaintiffs have received. The answer to that, as the record makes clear, is the plaintiffs have received the entire public information list. They've gotten everything that's on the public information list. Now, Judge Werke then asked if a detailed history of the elections has been refused. I think that's a reference to voting history. Voting history is the field on the database that states that voter X voted in the November 2018 election, the August 2018 election, the November 2016 election, et cetera. It doesn't say who you voted for, but it does say that you voted. That's voting history. Voting history under Subdivision 4 explicitly is part of the public information list. So yes, the detailed history of the elections has been given to the plaintiffs. Judge Werke asked Mr. Cardall if the detailed history had been refused. Mr. Cardall said yes, that's incorrect. The public information list contains that detailed history, and the plaintiffs have gotten it. The other point that then came out of the court's, I think, well-stated questions about the safety at risk voters and the risk that they are now under. The initial response Mr. Cardall had is that he doesn't think that the ruling he's seeking and the district court's ruling exposes their data. It is then incumbent on somebody, on the plaintiffs, on the district court, to explain why. Why does the district court's ruling, why does the ruling the plaintiffs are seeking not expose that data to access by the public, which means access by the stalker or the domestic abuser or whatever. Again, under the final paragraph of Subdivision 4, the only thing that happens to that safety at risk voter's name is that it's pulled off of the public information list. That's all that happens. So it is then necessary to find something else in this statute that says information that's off of the public information list is as a consequence not public. Subdivision 9 doesn't do that. Subdivision 9 covers very specific kinds of data, passport numbers and social security numbers and so on.
Mr. Hartshorn, but doesn't that name come from the same database where all of this information
yes.
is? Once that name's pulled, that kind of leads to my earlier question, isn't it pulled for all information that's provided?
No, it's only, under that paragraph, it's only pulled from the public information list. It's not pulled from the database. It's still in the database. It's only pulled from the public information list. The public information list is a subset of the database. So what that paragraph says is the name is pulled off of the public information list. And everyone agrees the necessary consequence of that pull has to be that makes it not public. Otherwise, you're exposing it.
Counsel, I know you don't have a lot of time, but I just have a quick question.
Sure.
I don't know how quick it is, but the information that was sought by the respondents that was not given to them.
Yes.
What information was it, and why was it not given to them?
Effectively, it's everything in the database, outside of the Subdivision 9 stuff, everything in the database except what's in the public information list. They asked for the entire database other than the Sub 9 stuff. the secretary gave him the public information list because under the statute they have the right to that. That the secretary said that the rest of this is protected.
But
by,
am I correct in suggesting the Secretary of State could have made the opposite decision had he chosen to under the statute?
And you're referring to the discretion in Subdivision 4.
The last line, may.
Right, yep. Insofar as he made the necessary conclusion here that it was a request related to elections, political activities.
Well, and that was stipulated to, wasn't it?
I don't think there's a dispute that request fits that. But yes, the secretary did under the discretionary provision in sub 4 did have the authority to provide that particular information. And it's important in that, yes, that the plaintiffs are not seeking the Subdivision 9 information, right, because Subdivision 9 would not permit the secretary to give up that precise information. One other thing I just want to touch on is that counsel, I think, very properly referred the court to 13.607 because that mentions 201.091 as one of the non-DPA provisions that governs access to government data. I don't understand how counsel put the meaning on Subdivision 1 that he did, though. Subdivision 1 of 13.607 says that the listed statutes, which include our statute, classify campaign ethics and election data as other than public, place restrictions on access to government data, or involve data sharing. Well, 201.091 does all three of those things. Council submitted that it only involves data sharing. Well, it does that, but it also places restrictions on access to government data. I mean, explicitly in Subdivision 1, among other places, and Subdivision 9. So it does all three of those things. And then one very last point is the representation council has made that this statute is only an instruction to the county auditors. To the contrary, the sentence in sub 1 and the sentence in sub 4 that we're relying on, sentence in sub 4 explicitly lists the Secretary of State may. The sentence in sub 1 applies to the world. This information may only be provided to, et cetera. That's all I have. The secretary would request that this court reverse the district court's decision and rule that the information that the plaintiffs are seeking in this matter is not accessible by the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys. The matters were well briefed as